hands are empty.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're very happy to have all of you here tonight. As Johanna just said, this is crazy for a Friday evening to have an audience like
exactly.
this. You should all be out on the streets or in the bars or wherever you want to be. I'd like to introduce
exactly.
the lady of the moment, Johanna Trollope, all the way from England. Come to South Africa.
No, I have to say at this point that I went, because I'm very keen on literacy as a project, and I went to visit a literacy NGO in Cape Town yesterday called Life Matters. And I was amazed that the children have such a narrow frame of reference. And I said to a group of little boys, I'm from England, and the teacher said they have no idea about that. She said to them, she's from overseas. And one little boy said to me, does that mean you came in an aeroplane? I did.
The truth is, of course, she did come in an aeroplane and her luggage went on without her. So this is a little skinner. But Johanna's beautiful jacket, may I? Yeah?
Yes.
This is from Woolworths because she needs clothes. So.
I bought it from Marks and Spencer in the UK online.
Oh, Woolworths, sorry. And Marlene Breitenbach is a well-known Afrikaans romance novelist, as you all know, and has very, very many titles to her name. She is one of the most prolific writers, and she's terribly busy, and you might know from Facebook and stories around town that she goes to her computer every morning, sits down, whacks out a story, then talks to a cat. And so the cat knows more about what goes on in Marlene's life. And I'm Marty Meiring, I'm not a writer, I'm a journalist.
The same cat, always. Has it always same been cat. The same cat?
Alexander the Great.
It is, yes. Yes, obviously a significant cat.
Johanna, I heard the other day that you had actually started your career as a writer after your third child was born.
No, I can I just say at this point, I've just, you know, this festival, as you know, is all in Afrikaans, which I don't speak. So I've only just got a description of myself for this festival, and I cannot describe to you how inaccurate it is. It says I'm the doyenne of romance novels. I don't think I write romance novels.
Well, that's not your fault.
I think a best-selling author of international. She's had several husbands, the last one much younger than her 70-plus years. I haven't been married to anybody for over 20 years.
Husbands.
It's extraordinary, but certainly I'm not that. She abhors writers who are constantly on Twitter. I don't abhor them at all. I don't do social media, but everybody else is perfectly free to. She has the accent, pearls, and two-piece appearance of an upper-class lady. Excuse me.
I'm wearing the pearls.
Where did they get that from?
Oh, I don't know.
It's extraordinary. She is besotted with writing, particularly about women in general and women in our time. She talks about the lack of novels in which women refuse to be superwomen and openly choose careers over families and children. None of that's true.
No, of course that is true, that you do choose women yes. who choose careers.
But I do. Right, yeah.
The truth is here, of course.
I don't know where all that came from. You promised.
And not anybody I know who actually no. wrote that. But of course...
Well, perhaps it's Elmari and Suzanne and co. I mean, I don't know. But anyway,
I will tell you that in this country, we do have very strange communications on social media. And we're actually known for that. So right. it could be, for all we know, a politician.
It could be. Could be.
Seven could husbands be. An English lady. They are.
No, I've had two, but I haven't had any husband at all for over 20 years.
Really?
No.
Oh.
No.
Is that okay?
Absolutely. And certainly the idea of a husband 20 years younger than me is extraordinary.
Why? I mean...
Never done such a thing.
No, but
Where did they find that?
I don't know.
I'm so disappointed.
But don't you agree that women could actually marry men
yes.
20 years younger?
Of course
30
they
years.
Could. Of course
who's
could.
That great actress who has a man who's 45 years younger than she is? She's an
yes.
English actress.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
But I think also younger men have been brought up by all of us to be much more accepting of women being women in their own right.
Yes,
yeah, no, that's true.
But the men of my generation, in England anyway, are far more set in their ways.
Really?
And they're terrified of... Well, they feel threatened, I think, by successful women.
We don't have that here, you know.
You don't.
You lie, Marty, you lie.
There you go.
I'm actually going to ask Marlene, who is a good researcher, to tell the truth about you.
Oh, right.
Oh, you know,
you can do
I
your best.
Googled you so much. I've actually watched you speak and beautiful English. I think I know you very well by now.
But you might not know the real me. You might just know the social media me, which is obviously
yes.
Full of fantasy.
Oh, tonight's
well,
the night.
Tonight we will interrogate you and find out. Now, I must tell everybody, well... You are the doyenne of romance novels, aren't you?
No, not romance novels. No, I write novels about contemporary relationships, current relationships.
Yes.
Yeah.
Socio-political novels.
Ooh. And your social commentary and insight into the human psyche make your books very sought after. You really are very successful. You have written so many books. They've been translated. And four of them have been adapted to TV.
They have,
by
yeah.
the BBC.
Yeah.
And I must mention here, in 2010, she won the Romantic Novelists Association's Lifetime Achievement Award. She has written historical and contemporary novels and nonfiction. Her books have been translated into 25 languages, and
but
they're
not
usually
Afrikaans.
Yeah, the only language that should have them.
Well, you watch it, you might translate it now. And you top the bestseller lists as soon as your book is published. And then four of your books were adapted into TV series. Or has there been more?
But what about the 7 million copies?
The 7 million copies?
7 million, I read that somewhere. Mm. 7 million copies of your books have been sold across...
Have they?
Well, I read it.
Yeah.
But you know what's amazing about that is that you are quintessentially English, British English. And these books are translated into all kinds of languages, and the people like them very much. But
don't you think a broken heart is a broken heart, whether it's happening in
yes.
Tokyo or here
yeah.
or, you know, it does it matter?
Yeah.
I think human beings, you know, there is a great need to be needed and loved and emotionally secure,
yes.
men and women. The world over.
Mm.
We all need that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, in fact, you think that an Albanian heart is very much the same as an English and an Afrikaner heart?
Well, I don't imagine that Albanians feel very differently, actually.
Divorce is the same?
I would think so. Mm. I think there's something about the human race that means there is a universality of desire and need. Irrespective, you know, we eat different food, we wear different clothes, we have, you know, the culture dictates a difference, but the human being has got an awful lot in common with other human beings, I think.
Yes, what I found very interesting, and you know, we don't have too many titles of you in South Africa, so Pan Macmillan will have to do some work now.
Yes, exactly.
And what I found very interesting is, in fact, your dissection of family life, and in the City of Friends, where you have the four protagonists, four ladies, four girls, who are into business, and you know, one's husband is a houseman, and one doesn't have a husband, she's a lesbian, and then the other loses her job through sort of male
chauvinism. Yeah. Mm.
Well, and what I find, why I think men should read your books, is in fact that. And I'm not a romance novelist, a reader at all. I actually don't have time or the inclination, but I do like some novels. But I think men would find resonance in your books, because men are actually portrayed as human beings.
Very much so.
They're not this guy on a white horse, or they're not this old slushy type. Men are men with souls, and they understand, and don't always understand, but try to understand the family situation. So, personally, I think from the books that I've read that men should actually read your books.
Well, maybe they're packaged wrongly for men to read, because, you know, a man will buy the latest John Grisham or Bernard Cornwell or something.
Yeah.
Because, or Wilbur Smith, because it looks kind of blokey.
Yeah,
and maybe, you know, the books look too feminine. And they'd be embarrassed. I used to get quite a lot of letters, now it's emails, saying I just happened to pick up my girlfriend's copy of something or other.
Oh, I see. So they're still cagey.
Well, I think so. And you know, it's a generational thing, isn't it?
And your books are non-violent.
Exactly.
And well, maybe like to read about violence.
Not enough action?
No, there's an awful lot of action,
well,
I think.
There is,
but, you know, you think, where's the crime novelist?
Here she is.
Well, maybe men are happier reading crime. You know, that's allowed. But, you know, I think men are very hard on each other. Mm-hmm. You know, the culture is still saying, you know, to be a real man, you've got to be able to chop down a tree and fire a gun and all of that.
You think
so? What about emotion?
Yeah, this is what I find in your books, the titles that I could read, that men do have emotions.
Of course they do.
Yeah.
No, of course they do. And I think, and it's the same with children. You know, children, I think most children's childhood is quite anxious. You know?
Yes.
It's not a period of undiluted happiness, because children are quite worried.
Especially in puberty.
No, I agree. No, I agree completely.
But you do seem to, you know, often people say, I can't get into the opposite sex's shoes and really describe how they feel. But you've managed that very well. And you've done it
without
well
those
with
four husbands.
Well.
Or seven husbands.
Well, I've only had two. And I haven't had anybody for ages. But, you know, I think the thing I would champion my books for is that they are about real life. You know, they are about reality. They are about what it's like to be alive now in a civilized society, trying to live life with all these changes going on. The fact is, I mean, you were talking very kindly about City of Friends. The thing is that most women now work. It might be quite rare for women of my generation, the next generation, they mostly work. The generation of, say, my grandchild, my granddaughter, who's, let me think, she's 20.
I think it fell off.
No. I think for my granddaughter, she wouldn't think of not working. And I think most young women are the same. You know, and this idea of there are no novels I can see about women and work.
Yeah.
It's really extraordinarily old-fashioned, isn't it?
But your stories are about women juggling their lives.
Well, that's
a profession, a husband, children, difficult teenagers and so on. And she has to manage all that. Yes. And highly paid jobs, like in this book of yours.
So, can you do something? Well, it's oh, that's better. You glued it to my cheek with something clever, which obviously I talk wrongly and it unstuck itself.
Are we all right? Are we all here? Can we all learn?
Yeah.
Oh God, there I go.
Mine is still here.
Okay. Now I was going to say I sound like a voice from hell, but Marlene is also terribly. We've been talking and skindering about you a lot, you know, because I actually heard this evening that one of your forebears was your great grand uncle Anthony Trollope, has a special relationship with South Africa.
Well, I think he came, didn't he?
Yeah, he was here, and he wrote about it.
Yes, he did.
Yeah. Mm. Are you?
Well, he travelled, he went round the world. He died in 1882. And at that period, he had, by then, circumnavigated the world twice, which was quite a complicated thing to do.
Strange.
He'd have loved a laptop.
Around the world.
He'd have loved so he could just scribble on while he travelled.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
He would absolutely have loved it. And of course, I always think, I don't know whether you two feel the same, particularly Marlene, but whether that was the golden age of fiction, the 19th century.
Yes.
Because when I was writing my update of the Jane Austen novel of Sense and Sensibility, it was as if Jane Austen was writing in a literary genre that for us, for you and me, would have been about 1990. Because after all, if you think about it, Henry Fielding, who was the first really successful novelist, Tom Jones was published about just before Jane Austen even began. And there she was, an obscure parson's daughter in a parish in rural Hampshire, and she understood that fiction was going to be about love, romantic love, sex, culture, class, and money, power. And that is what it still is about, isn't it?
Yes, but you know, she sort of got in on the ground floor, didn't she? And she wrote these books. And she's been imitated ever since.
Ever since. Yes, if you go online, I think the Jane Austen imitations are now over 2,000.
Really?
Really?
Yeah. Yes, you know, other books inspired by Jane Austen.
Mostly in English, or do other languages actually?
Mostly in English, I think.
Mainly in English,
yes.
Yeah.
When I saw that you had done Sense and Sensibility in a modern version, that's my favourite, Jane.
It is.
I got it on Kindle, and I couldn't stop reading. I had to speak to you made of these heroes and heroines and how they would act in a modern environment. I really enjoyed it very much.
Well, it was sticking to Jane Austen's story like paint.
Yes.
Sticking to her characters, but also her attitude to her characters, because she teases almost everybody.
No, you caught it remarkably.
But
well.
The great drawback to taking Jane Austen's characters and transposing them to 2013, which is what I was doing, was they have all this leisure. They don't do anything. Because, of course, the great commodity of 18th century England was sugar, which was not a million miles from slavery. The Austens were all abolitionists, you'll be glad to hear.
Yeah, we are.
But it was an extraordinary thing. So all these young men, I mean, Mr. Bingley in Pride and Prejudice, who's only 22, and Mr. Darcy is, I think, 23, they have nothing to do. And you know Mr. Bingley just wants to organise parties between whatever it's called, the house he rents near the Bennets, and London.
Yeah,
he's got nothing else to do at all.
Yeah,
because he's got all this money.
Party, yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think Pemberley, Mr. Darcy's house, was probably built on the proceeds of the mines of Derbyshire. And what was the life of an 18th century miner like in England?
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely
it
unspeakable.
In Mansfield Park, where the father was actually a slave owner.
He is.
And he was wealthy.
Yes, and he disappears at one point, doesn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, that's true that there is, but, you know, there is a... you're always reminded to go back to Jane Austen.
Always.
And yes always in literature. And two, the sad thing is that, well, of course, she didn't live long enough, but the women were always, they were entranced by these strange characters, these mysterious characters. And,
but they had to have 5,000 a year.
But you had to marry because it was the only career for a gently born woman, wasn't
right,
it?
Yeah,
And you know, I should think there's as many different careers as there are people here tonight.
Yeah, when I look around at them, a lot of them aren't married.
Well, they don't need to be married.
No, they don't.
No, exactly.
And they aren't.
No.
But they have to be earning to live. They're all working.
But that kind of independence,
yes,
you know, was denied to my mother's generation. I mean, she died 5 years ago when she was 96. And she was dying to work. And, of course, she couldn't.
And yes, yeah.
Because society didn't permit her to.
Well, now...
And now all these young women can work. And should.
And should. And, you know, strangely enough, in this country, too, now, with the political situation as it is, and it's fair enough, too, is that the women find jobs easier than men do. It's a strange sort of situation.
Do you think that's because women work in a different way from men?
In a sense, I think women are a bit cheaper to, you know, to keep there. And also, there is, in South Africa, there is a kind of male situation right at the moment. Mm. You know, we have the labor situation and also the race situation, and yes, politics is right at the top now. Mm. So women in South Africa have, in the previous years, the apartheid years, there was a greater contact between black women and white women.
Yeah.
Black women were often the servants, but through them, white women actually got to know about the lives of black families. Mm. And that's a tremendous thing.
It is.
Yes. And I think, too, in, you know, modern literature, actually, that is something that resonates now. Mm. You know, women, they're more in contact.
Yes.
With what is happening.
But don't you think this still applies to women? Don't you think the way women work means they make relationships with everybody? So if you work, you get to know your whole workforce.
Mm. Mm. Mm.
Sorry, this thing has fallen off.
Yeah. Michael. Michael is our archangel. but the writing process... I know of my friends who are writers, you know, they're very dedicated people. And how many titles have you, do you have?
Goodness, I know that of the contemporary novels, I think An Unsuitable Match is the 21st.
Oh.
And then there's a great body of historical fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And one about the Boer War. But that will be under my other name, which
is Caroline Harvey.
Which is my Trollope grandparents' first names put together. Oh. So it kept it in the family.
Why did you have a pseudonym?
Well, it was the publisher's idea, because they thought, my then publisher, not Pound Macmillan, but my then publisher thought that it was very confusing for the audience to have the Joanna Trollope novels and then the historical novels, that the audience couldn't, the readership couldn't work it out. Well, of course the readership could work anything out.
Yeah.
But there we are. So all the Caroline Harveys are historical, and all the Joanna Trollopes are contemporary. And I've written one non-fiction
book. The one about the British woman? That was
yes,
non-fiction.
Yes, it's called Daughters of... What is it called? Britannia's Daughters. Thank you so much.
See, I Googled you.
Do you know, it happens all the time. I can't... When I come to a novel I've written some time ago, I have to ask endless audiences what the names of the characters are, because I can't remember.
Oh, I was going to ask
you really embarrassed. I'm really embarrassed about
it. Yes, Marlene's terribly gritty about your process. What do you do when you get up and have coffee and that one? That's not what you're going to ask in any case.
Now, you know, this idea of being a plotter.
Yes, I do plot them.
Mm.
Well, I start with a theme. I then I will then do the research around the theme. So it could be late life marriage, it could be adoption, it could be step families. Mm-hmm. You know, all kinds of topics could come up. The next one is about the generation, you know, the sort of 40s generation, when their parents are beginning to fall to pieces one end of their lives, their children are very demanding the other end of their lives, and they, the women, are working full time. So that's the starter of the book. Mm-hmm. Then I do the research. I always go and talk to people who are in this situation. To make sure, really, that I've got it right, that it really rings true, then I'll find the names of the characters, and that's usually by just looking in the press until a name leaps out at me as being right for that particular person. And then I decide where to set the book, and then I start writing it. So it's quite a long process. So I will plot maybe the first quarter of the book, because I don't know these people terribly well. I don't know where it's going. And I plot the end, so the book can develop organically as I go along, because I know where I've got to end up. So it's... In a way, it allows the book to develop as organically as real life does, but it's disciplined by the fact that I've got to end up in a particular place, and I really have. And when it comes to writing crime novels, I remember talking to Freddie Forsyth just after The Day of the Jackal had been published and such a global success. And Freddie Forsyth said to me he wrote it backwards to make sure that nothing, no end was left untied at the end. And I don't know if this is how crime writing works, but I know it's a very different process. Because you have to make sure that you end up quite neatly at the end. And the crime writer P.D. James, who you will remember, who lived till she was about 94, I remember her describing her novels, her crime novels, as small celebrations of order. So in a chaotic world, the white hats get rewarded, the black hats get punished, and the reader has a great sense of satisfaction at the end of it. And you will notice, if you look at the bestseller list now, because the world is in such chaos, the crime novels will probably form about 9 out of the top 10, yes, or 7 anyway. It's quite interesting. Mm-hmm. People need the reassurance of something being certain.
And solved.
Yes.
That's very, very interesting.
It is, isn't it?
That they are, yeah, there's this need to, yeah, structure.
And the same is true of romance novels, but in a fantasy direction.
Yes.
You need to be taken away from real life and the dismalness of going to the Pick and Pay, and you've got to imagine something that is hardly likely to happen.
Do you ever paint yourself into a corner and think, oh my goodness, I've got to get out of this, what have I done?
I've certainly scrapped various bits of writing as I go along, but I have to tell you, the way I do it is longhand. I'm still writing longhand.
Really?
in A4 pads. I can't possibly write on a computer. I can do journalism on a computer, but I simply can't write novels on
but
a computer.
Why?
Because I need the silence. I think probably there's an idea that there's a particular artery, you know, from my brain to this hand.
Mm. And the historic novels? You wrote it by hand?
Oh, I wrote everything by hand. I've written millions of words by hand.
And now it's all in the Bodleian Library.
The Bodleian Library has taken my archive. Well, I've given it to them. Mm-hmm. You can sell your archive to an institution, an air-conditioned institution in Austin, Texas. But I wanted my novels to stay in England, I'd been at Oxford.
Yeah, well, Joanna, the unsuitable marriage, an unsuitable match. As I say, you know, I think the last really romantic novel I read was Mills of Boons, but this was really a beautiful novel to me, but I was so sad about the thing that didn't work out.
Well, of course, yes, but you know, he was a bad egg. He was hopeless with money.
He was hopeless, but
such a nice man. And I mean, he was hopeless with money, but lots of us marry men who are hopeless with money.
I
marry them, but
do you know? I think if you are. I think it depends what age you're at. Mm-hmm. And I think if you are fertile, your physiology dictates how you behave. And I just don't think later on you have quite this, especially if you've been independent.
Well, he wanted to go and live somewhere in the country in a little cottage.
Well, it was about control, wasn't it?
Well, it was about money.
But do you want to be controlled by anybody? Do you really?
Yeah. Yes.
No.
And her children were all against it.
Yes.
I was reading madly towards the end to see, is she now going to marry this man? He is unsuitable.
Yes, he is unsuitable.
Yes.
But she was going to leave that beautiful house. So she left it in any case.
Yes. She needed
did.
Money.
Well, yeah, there's that to it. Somebody in the audience wanted to ask you about whether you have a psychological background. And I don't mean something wrong with you.
No. There is a lot wrong with me.
Studied psychology.
A lot wrong with me. No, I don't have any psychological experience, but it sort of seems to be there in the fiction.
Well, you're a good observer of people, of children, of men and women. It's really amazing, you know, and your dialogue is very good. But of course, well, you say you go on public transport and listen to people talking.
I think that's really the answer, really.
Don't people recognize you?
No, not in England, and certainly nobody under the age of about 50 ever does. And I mean, my desire is to be with my back against a wall watching a party going on. I want to listen to, say, David and Victoria Beckham, but I don't want to meet them. I just want to see what they're like in company and make a note of it mentally.
I just
am a listener. Yeah. I think most people who write fiction, it's either entirely about themselves or they are very, very watchful.
I don't know which you are. Yes, you know, one is always observing other people. And when they expect you to talk, you don't. You just listen. You absorb.
Exactly.
Who has influenced you the most as far as your writing is concerned? Other writers or whatever?
Well, I think there's quite a lot of women writers who've been very influential, but I think really the influence has been 19th century fiction.
Really?
It was
yeah,
so...
We'll go back.
Because they were constrained, if you think how much the culture of the time influenced their attitudes, but they were all really very watchful.
Who were the other writers? Georgette Heyer was later, wasn't she?
Yes, she was. I don't really admire her. I think she's remarkable. And the novel she wrote about Waterloo, the Battle of Waterloo, which I think is called A Near Run Thing, it is taught at Sandhurst Military College because nobody has described the formation of the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
And who came to whose rescue as well as she's done.
Amazing.
But I think that's not a... That's, it's rather like a novelist describing what it was like in the 12th century. You know, the building of a cathedral or something. What about the 12th century mentality? You've got to be truthful to your own times, which is why... the 20th century or the 21st century really suits me. You know, that the post-Freudian is very different from pre-Freudian.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
Yes, indeed.
Well, yes, of course.
I mean, all those trips changer. Around the inside of your own head are post-Freud. But before that, it was codes of conduct, really.
Yeah, that is a big thing, code of conduct.
It is.
And now with this freedom that we have, this boundless freedom.
But people had a sense of honour, which they seem to have lost.
Well, I think moral relativism has had its day. I think people are beginning to say, is this the right way to behave?
Mm-hmm.
And you can see now... there's beginning to be a return to that sense of community, that sense of responsibility. Because we've had a free-for-all, haven't we? Whereas you just pleased yourself and you behaved in the way that suited you. And it doesn't work, does it?
Does it?
No.
Joanna, the prison situation, the whole Brexit situation.
Oh, isn't it awful?
Yeah,
it
is awful. But how does this affect you as a writer and a thinker about the situation? Do you see a break, a chasm in British life? Or
no.
Not?
Mm-hmm. I think most people who voted to leave thought it could be done in 2 or 3 days.
Yes, yeah.
And of course it can't.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to write about it?
No, I'm going to glancingly refer to it because it's too enormous not to, but actually it is beyond tedious. the machinations
I know,
of it.
I know, it is.
It really is. And so and we're all exhausted by it, and it's been so lovely being here for a week.
Really?
Because I've had a holiday from all that rubbish.
Oh, yes, but you're not into our political rubbish, so that's
well. No, I'm rather conscious of the complications here, yes. Yes.
Because you're so sensitive to a situation and an environment, I thought that I know it's terribly boring for us too, this whole Brexit. We don't really understand it. And
no, you're quite right not to understand it.
Well, we do feel sorry for Theresa May because I guess she's becoming thin.
No, she's a classic only child of elderly parents, and she's...
There's your story.
She's nothing like as clever as we thought she was going to be. And she's obstinate and stubborn. Well, I think she's a disaster, really. She thinks she's now going to get us up to the wire, where we're going to have got a catastrophe. So we'll agree to her ridiculous deal. No, we won't.
Oh dear.
No.
Oh, good. You've now put us into the picture.
Yes, exactly.
We
should never have left Europe in the first place.
No. But then the vote was in any case, it was very, very strange, very close.
Well, it was again.
Yeah.
It was like Trump, it was distorted, and social media had something to do with it.
Mm. I want to ask you to get back to your books. Was your first book published straight away?
No.
Well, Tolkien and J.K. Rowling were, their books were rejected, so you're in good company.
I think, I remember a hugely successful writer in due course, somebody of the stature of Freddie Forsyth, opening a cupboard once on television to show the cascade of rejection slips that he'd had. And I think that's true of almost any writer. And I feel now, looking back, that the lack of success at the beginning was absolutely right. The world wasn't ready for my kind of fiction.
Good for you.
Because I think in the 80s, it was all about the airport blockbuster. Do you remember those novels with sex on a white mink bedspread and embossed covers on things?
High mile thing, yeah.
And it was all sort of fantastical in that kind of way. And the world had to be ready for some kind of realism.
But once you were published, it took off. And it's been plain sailing ever since.
No, not till about the third or fourth novel.
Really?
But the same with J.K. Rowling. I remember it was about the third novel, Harry Potter and... it wasn't The Goblet of Fire. The Philosopher's Stone. It was the third novel that took off. Mm. And because we shared a publishing house, we shared with at Bloomsbury together. Mm. And she's a very interesting, dry-witted, rebarbative girl. And I remember the managing director of the company of Bloomsbury Publishing being begged to stay with her.
Good heavens.
Because, the girl promoting her could see that this was about to hit the jackpot.
And now she's a multimillionaire.
But I think that's not a desirable position to be in.
No,
I think because then you're trapped by your own wealth and your own success. It's another gilded cage. You can only meet other really rich people. Mm. And who wants to do that, really?
Well, I don't know.
No, you don't. You don't. You don't, Marty. You really don't. You want to have the freedom to be invisible, just to be a person. And the moment you're hugely successful, you can't be.
but you are hugely successful, and four of your books have been adapted for TV.
Well, so I'm not successful as far. I might be successful for your generation, but nobody's heard of me under 40.
But how did it feel when the first one was adapted? You must have been thrilled.
Yay!
Well, no, because in those days I had no clout. I couldn't say to them, I don't think it should be this way. It was the last one, which was, I think, was adapted with other people's children, where I could say, no, we're going to be realistic here. We're going to have a scruffy house. We're going to have horrible people who are just like real life. You know, I'm always saying to people, you must be able to identify people who exasperate you in life as well as people you identify with. And I was then well enough known, I'd got enough power to say to the television company,
did you approve of the actors? Did you think
yes,
they were
I
right
chose,
in the roles?
Yes, I could choose them.
Oh, that's good.
You know, by then, the producer, the director, was saying to me, does X seem to me to be right for this character? Hmm. But I couldn't do it earlier. No, the initial, I think the choir was the first.
Yes.
And it was ludicrously sentimental.
I did watch.
I mean,
that
full
on
of
TV.
Full of sunsets and you know,
James
an orchestra. Well, James Fox came to dinner to get the character right, and you know, the moment the television camera was on him, he'd got a poker up his bottom, and he was hopeless.
And he turned back into James Fox.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
So, Joanna, we've got to congratulate you that you eventually achieved all that fame. And so, is anybody in the audience, are there any questions you'd like to, or suggestions? Or could we ask, are you busy with something else right at the moment?
Well, there'll be a new book out. I've said no publication for this year. And so, because I'm just so bored with the promotion side of things. So the next one will be out it's called Mum and Dad, and it'll be out in February 2020.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And you're working on the next one now?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know the exact date, February 2020.
Well, that's because I've said,
please give
me a year off. Mm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
What is the proudest moment in your life?
Oh, I think...
When you got the OBE?
No, I think it was giving birth.
Oh.
No, really? I think it was the children, yeah.
Usually is, isn't it?
Mm. Mm.
Shall we ask the audience, and then you could ask a few questions too, because you've got a lot to want
I've
to ask.
I've reached the end.
Is there anybody you'd like to ask something or suggest something? We have a hand at the back. That's Elmarie.
You received the OBE. What is it like? Do you actually meet the Queen?
How does that happen?
Tell us all about that.
The crown is very big in South Africa.
Well, she's amazing, the Queen, and I'm so admiring of her. And what is she now, 92?
Four? Three?
Two, something incredible.
But in any case. Mm.
So I got the OBE about... I don't know, about 15 or even more years ago. And I remember thinking she was, however much I admire her, which I really, really do, she's very bored by women who write novels. What she likes is an action man. She was dying to get to the policeman from Hong Kong and all of that kind of thing. So even though there was Lord Chamberlain or somebody whispering in her ear that this was Joanna of Trollope and she wrote novels, she said to me, in that inimitable Queen voice, she said, is it a amusing writing novels. And I said, actually, Mum, it's very hard work. And as she's pinning the OBE on you, she then gives you a little push with her hand to make sure that you know the interview is over. So you then curtsy rather inadequately in my part, on my part.
Did you have to practice
and off you go.
That curtsy before?
Yes, you do. You do.
And well, you're doing it. A long dress.
You're doing it in heels. No, I was in a suit, I think, but I was certainly in heels.
If you, you have to, it would be terrible.
Yes, it would be. Although I think there's always somebody there to pick you up. You know, there's some flunky or other. So, in retrospect, I think, although I was very honoured to be given an OBE by the Queen, I think I'd rather it had been Prince Charles, actually, who I think would have been more sympathetic and more interested.
Do you think
he's
Prince
a nice
Charles
man.
Is going to take over?
Oh, I think he will for about 3 minutes.
You know, South Africans are terribly interested in the royal family.
Yes, I know. What do you know? What's the Graham Viney book about? Called
yes, the last
Hurrah. About, yes. Mm. Well, it was really interesting because I went to his event and Rian Milan was the only writer I'd heard of in the entire festival, I have to say. So, and he and Graham Viney, I thought, really detested each other because they sat in complete silence before the
of
and
course.
During the event. You know, and I don't know why Rian had agreed to do it.
Well, part of it is confrontation, and Rian is, we know he's a confrontational man.
He is.
Too, yeah. And of course, you know, the Queen's visit, the royal visit, was a big thing for the Afrikaners too.
Yes.
Because before the present royal family came, the previous Prince of Wales came. And this
time... Oh, really? Oh, did he? So
oh,
he came. Was the Duke of Windsor came.
He was here, I think, in the late 20s or early 30s. But Stellenbosch, you know, is an Afrikaans town.
Very much so.
Mad about the British royalty. And when he came, he had the Prince of Wales. He had such a fantastic time. He didn't want to go away.
Oh, really?
My granduncle was actually mayor at the time. He didn't approve of the Prince of Wales.
No, he was quite right not to.
Yeah, because he was, yeah, you know, he was such a playboy.
He was. Yeah.
So. Actually, you know, I was at school in the old Rhodesia, which is Zimbabwe now, and the Queen and Princess Margaret and all came to visit.
Yes.
But our little town of Gwelo wasn't important enough for the Queen. She just sort of passed through and you saw this white glove that did that. But Princess Margaret actually came,
did
and
she?
I saw her from, you know, close by, and she was very pretty.
Well, she must
at that stage.
She must
she
only have been 17 or 18.
Yes, then. She was.
She
young.
Was. She was ravishingly pretty.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Poor thing.
Poor thing.
Joanna, the future of fiction, this kind of fiction. The print, in print. Does that bother you?
Not in the least.
That it's going to be digital, most of it?
I don't know about here, but in the UK, the digital reading has kind of... It's on the way down. The sales of Kindles and things have flattened
yeah.
out.
Mm-hmm.
And the sales of print books have
going up.
Risen. Well, I think there's two reasons for this. One is you cannot furnish a room with technology.
And you can try.
The second thing is duller in a way, in that you don't own a book if you download it digitally. You can't, for example, leave your library to a grandchild. Because you're only licensed to read a book digitally for the length of time it takes
That's
you to
right.
read it.
It'll take 20 years.
And I've I've experienced that enormously with book prizes, because I thought when I was judging, I think it was the Whitbread Prize, that's fine. I can download 120 novels and read them on my Kindle. And I couldn't remember one novel from another. You have to remember that this is a big, fat, pink book, or a very small green book, or whatever it is. And I sort of feel there's a respect to the author in visualizing the book in the livery in which they saw it. They imagined it going out into the world.
Yeah.
I think it's all very dismal. Mm-hmm. And the only good thing, I think, is self-publishing, except I very much suspect that the only people making money out of self-publishing are Amazon.
Well, we have a lady here who is not self-publishing, but she is a publisher. And have you found, too, that print paper is actually going up? Absolutely.
Is it really?
Oh, yeah, digital is really going down. Well, isn't that wonderful, huh?
It is.
So it's part of our decor, too, now, all these...
It is.
These books.
Well, books furnish a room like nothing else.
Yeah.
Wonderful things.
But now I don't have your sense and sensibility in a hard copy. It's on Kindle. I have about 500 books on that Kindle, which is rather sad. And I haven't found it in a bookstore, but it's probably somewhere. Let's just go looking.
I think it's probably just a question of looking for it on Abe Books or something.
Yes. No.
I'm afraid so.
Are there any other questions? There is a lady, yes. Hello. There you are. Oh.
Are you a disciplined writer? Do you write?
Very.
10,000 words a day or 8 hours a day?
When I have a book on the go, I know that I've got to write X thousand words a week. So I look at the diary. I have a paper diary. I have an old-fashioned paper diary. And I strike out whole days, because who knows how long it's going to... When is the bluebird of inspiration going to strike me at that particular day? It's often rather dismally before lunch. It's almost never late at night anymore. I'm too old for that. But it could be in that rather dead bit of the day between 5 and 7. And I just know that I've got to have a completely empty day to work.
Do you want to write a certain number of words on a day?
I know I've said this before, but I think inspiration is often engendered by spreading the bills out on the kitchen table.
Absolutely.
I think you've got to regard writing as a profession, not a kind of, oh, it's all about me. I think it's got to be, A, all about somebody else and something else, but it's got to be taken seriously professionally. Don't you think?
Absolutely. There's a lady down
there.
Thank you.
I've got a sort of a people's question as opposed to a book question.
Yeah. Where are you?
I'm here.
Yes, I see.
Yes, Suzanne. The question is, why do you think younger men are attracted to older women and the other way around, possibly? That's an odd question just for fun.
I think... younger men have been brought up by all of us. So they are not hidebound by the conventions of older men, where there was no emotion and other men were judging them terribly harshly, and they had to be physically extremely accomplished, and they never spoke about their feelings. And younger men are longing to have children. You can see young men with their babies. Their approach is quite different and much more hands-on. and they see older women as personalities. I think they can, because I think we've done a very good job bringing them up.
Good. Somebody else has a question. I think that would be the last question.
I'm still so intrigued by your knowledge.
Where are you? Oh, yes, I found you.
I'm so intrigued by your knowledge and your insight into relationships. And you made the comment about your Prime Minister about being the only child. I was wondering what was your childhood like? And because you have such a, you know, empathy and, yeah, relationships seems to me more your thing than being
it
a
is.
Writer. So
it
I
is.
Often in the beginning thought you were actually a therapist, to be quite honest.
Well, I was born in the Second World War. My father, having begat me, had disappeared to India with his regiment, and he didn't reappear till I was nearly four, like a lot of people of my age in England. And so I was born at the very end of 1943, which gives you all a very good idea of how old I am. And then my brother and sister, because I was the oldest, my brother and sister were born after the war when my father came back. And I think family life was an uneasy thing. I think my mother longed to work, longed to be part of this generation where society said she couldn't be. She was extremely beautiful and a very good painter, very good artist generally, drew like an angel, and I think was frustrated and disappointed all her life because society said she couldn't do what she longed to do. And it's my poor old dad had dementia for about 15 years. I can't actually remember him making much sense. It was and my mother was in complete denial about this being the case. So it's been complicated, but I wouldn't actually change it for anyone else's life. You know, it's got huge disadvantages, there are great lacks, there are inadequate relationships in it, but it doesn't really matter. I don't mind about it terribly. And I have 9 grandchildren. The youngest is 10 and the oldest is 20. And I have a really, really good relationship with them, and I find them absolutely fascinating, and they are quite different as a generation. They are much more liberated about people, much less hidebound by convention and what society expects of them. And all of that is really very good indeed. I hope that's enough.
That's lovely. Lovely. Thank you very much. I'm afraid time's up. Joanna, thank you very,
well,
very much.
Well, thank you both so much. That was
and
just
Aline,
gorgeous.
Thank you. This
wonderful.
Is a lekker chat. Huh?
Oh, we were thrilled to have you.
Well, it was so sweet of you both. Thank you very, very much
we're
indeed.
So pleased
and thank you all hugely for coming.
Good.